these four men. Through the courtesy of the National Broadcasting Company, the WILL Playhouse brings you the third in a special series of four broadcasts presenting the life stories of the four men most talked about in the world today. This is the story of a poor little rich boy who refused to have life handed to him on a silver platter, who worked and achieved greatness the hard way, of a burning ambition and a refusal to admit that an opposition was too big. This is the story of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. When he was inaugurated in 1932, that was by no means Franklin Roosevelt's first visit to the White House. Let's go back to the White House study of Grover Cleveland in the year 1887.
Ah, come in, come in. Glad to see you.
I know how busy you are, Mr. President. It was good of you to see us.
And why shouldn't I see you, James, after the way you worked for my election as governor of New York? Yes, and you helped make me president, too. Well, who's the young sailor you've got with you?
Mr. Cleveland, I want you to meet my son, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
How do you do, Mr. Cleveland?
Why, how do you do, young man?
He's quite a big young man to be only five, Mr. President?
Only five? Why, I was about to offer him a cigar. All dressed up in his sailor suit. I suppose when you grow up, young man, you want to be president too, eh?
No, sir. I want to be a sailor.
You've got a mighty smart son there, James. I've had 2 years of this job, and I know it isn't easy.
The country thinks you're doing a good job, Mr. President.
I do my best, James, but nobody seems to realize the sheer labor, the heartbreak, the awful sense of responsibility this office carries with it. Young man, I want to make a wish for you. I wish you great happiness and good health, and may you never become President of the United States.
In 1893, at the age of 11, Franklin Roosevelt had his first experience in action with the ideal which men and nations have come to know as liberty. It was in the office of the Imperial Guard in the fortified city of Strasbourg, Germany. Just after dark, the lieutenant of the guard was amusing himself with a music box.
Hey, Lieutenant! Hey, Lieutenant!
Yeah, Corporal? What is it?
The guard, Herr Lieutenant. The guard with the two prisoners.
Prisoners, Hein? Then the officer of the guard should not receive them while playing a music box. There. Two, did you say?
Prisoners, Achtung! March! Prisoners, out! Corporal Lenz, Herr Lieutenant. Two prisoners.
Yes, I see. One's rather small, isn't he? Young man, what is your name?
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Age?
11, going on 12.
Nationality?
The United States of America. This is my tutor with me.
I see that paper, sir, in order, Corporal. Charge?
Charge. Placed under arrest for trying to enter His Imperial Germanic Majesty's fortified city of Strasbourg on or with a wheeled vehicle after dark.
We were on bicycles, sir, and it was your guard's fault we're so late. They hadn't arrested us so many times today, we'd have been here before dark.
Ah, to Lieber, you were arrested more than once today?
The first time was when the goose ran in front of my bike.
Yeah, yeah.
Arrested and fined 5 marks. Then there were the cherries.
Cherries?
Oh, they were growing beside the road. Arrested again. And we took our bikes through the waiting room at the station.
Illegal, Doc. Yes, illegal.
But that was the only way to get to the train. The soldiers got us just the same. All that made us so late trying to get back to our hotel that we...
Then you were arrested again. Trying to enter Strasbourg after dark.
In the United States, we don't arrest people every time they turn around.
I will do, if you please. Corporal Lanz.
Yeah, Herr Oberlieutenant.
You are to be congratulated on your proficiency in protecting the Empire. You may go.
Yeah, Herr Oberlieutenant.
Well, if the fine is too much, I can't pay it. And that's that. I've already spent most of my allowance on fines.
Mr. Roosevelt, I know of your country. Perhaps someday I will go there to live. Here we do not do as we wish. In this country, we do as we are told. Ah, but perhaps you and the gentleman tutor will join me in my office for a piece of cake, hein?
In spite of the sweetening effect of the cake, young Roosevelt liked the American way best. Then, in the tradition of many American boys, he wanted to run away and go to sea. Later, his father talked him out of the notion of going to the Naval Academy. At 16, he was a student at Groton when, in the year 1898...
Remember the name!
Yes.
and Fred and Archie. Look, are you really going to do it?
That's right.
Gosh, you've got a cold, haven't you? But tell me, how'd you find out about it?
Oh, the pilot told us when he came Wednesday. The Navy's recruiting men for service in Cuba.
Just my luck. I'm only 14. If I were 16 like you...
Oh, the pieman will take us to Boston in his cart, and we'll go to Long Wharf and sign up. By the time they miss us on Monday morning, we'll be on a transport headed for Cuba.
Look, Frank, coming down the corridor, the monitor of the fourth form. Suppose he'll peach?
No, he's in on it. He's all right.
Frank, go off to the bedroom.
What's wrong?
He's sneezing. They're in the infirmary. Measles.
Measles? A kid disease like that?
Hey, look. Look at Frank. He's all broken out. Why... Why, Frank's got the measles, too.
Symptoms and triumphs flashing with the strains of victory.
The case of measles may have changed the entire course of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's life, for it stopped this attempt to become a part of the United States Navy. He remained at Groton, then went on to Harvard. There he became managing editor of the Harvard Crimson, and his editorials perhaps offer some clue to his later career.
Hey, man, have you seen Frank Roosevelt's latest piece in the Crimson?
What sort of a bee's he got in his bonnet now?
Yeah, what's Frank up to this time?
Remember how he told those college officials the buildings were fire traps? Right to their teeth, he told them.
He got action, didn't he? He put in fire escapes.
Yes, but this time a serious man. Listen to this. I'll read it. It is time the entire student body took an interest in the election of class officers. Too long, these elections have been controlled by one fraternity, by a few students who are wealthy aristocrats. Officers should be elected on the basis of ability, not because of background or present circumstances. There you are.
Frank can't do that to us. Why, our fraternity has always controlled class elections.
Yeah, and what does he mean, wealthy aristocrats? He's one of us himself, isn't he?
You know how Frank is. Always goes around sticking out his jaw in favor of the underdog.
But toward the end of his last year at Harvard, Frank Roosevelt sometimes seemed lost in thought, absent-minded. There was a reason. Her name was Anna Eleanor Roosevelt, his sixth cousin. His mother felt he was too young for marriage, so she arranged...
I finally persuaded Franklin to come on a West Indian cruise with me. He's bringing along Lathrop Brown, one of his classmates. He's too young for marriage yet. I want him to be ready for a career. He can go far. His father left many important friends in the business world. I think he knows I'm right, just as I know how impatient he is about waiting. Thank heavens he picked the right girl. There's no finer girl than Eleanor.
On St. Patrick's Day, 1905, Franklin Delano and Anna Eleanor Roosevelt were married. The bride was given away by her uncle, President Teddy Roosevelt himself. After his marriage, the groom continued his postgraduate studies at Columbia University, part of which he flunked. 5 years later, not yet 29, Roosevelt made his entry into politics as the result of a meeting in the town of Poughkeepsie.
Well, gents, if that's all the business, I think we've got a good slate of candidates. Mayor Sigg, you've got something to say?
It appears to me there's one candidate we've neglected to name. So far, there's been no mention of the Democratic candidate for state senator from the counties of Dutchess, Putnam, and Columbia.
Why name one? Only one Democrat's been elected from there in more than 50 years.
Yes, Mayor Sigg, and there's no money in the treasury for a useless campaign.
It still happens, gents. I've taken care of that. I've got a candidate who can pay his own freight. It's young Frank Roosevelt.
Will he make the race?
I've convinced him that he should. His mother was against it, said it was too undignified for a Roosevelt and would interfere with his career. I convinced her by telling her Frank didn't have a chance to win.
Well, honestly, I don't see why he'd bother with it.
Well, young Roosevelt's funny. Apparently doesn't know much about politics. He's got the idea he might be elected and would be able to do the people some good.
This Frank Roosevelt think he is? Been in the state senate 1 week and he thinks he's big enough to whip Boss Murphy and Tammany.
Murphy's determined he'll send blue-eyed Billy Sheena to the United States Senate.
Yes, but unless Frank Roosevelt and his little group vote for him, Boss Murphy is whipped.
Frank says blue-eyed Billy is a little too close to the New York Traction Trust to suit him.
Sure, why, if this thing goes far enough, it might get to where U.S. senators are elected by the people.
Blue-eyed Billy Sheehan of Buffalo did not go to the United States Senate, and the name of Franklin Roosevelt became one to reckon with in the New York State Senate. Then in the spring of 1913, as he planned his campaign for re-election, he was stricken with typhoid. And one day, at the Roosevelt home in Albany, a slight gnomish figure walked up the steps and entered the house. His name,
Lewis McHenry Howe.
Mr. Howe, come right in. Mr. Roosevelt's expecting you.
That you, Lewis? I've been waiting for you. Nice to see you.
I came as soon as I got Mrs. Roosevelt's call, Senator. I just started out upstate to do the pre-election roundup for my paper in New York.
And how are my chances shaping up in that story?
Good. Excellent until this typhoid. If you could make the kind of fight for yourself that you did to nominate Woodrow Wilson for president, well, I'm sorry, Senator.
I know. To be elected, it'll take a fight, and I can't make it. By the way, have you ever managed a political campaign?
Why, no. I've written about them for years, of course, but never...
Lewis, the doctors say I won't be out of bed for some time. If you still want to see me win, you'll have to take over my campaign and fight it.
Take over your campaign? Why, great Scott!
I believe you can do it, Lewis. But it's your decision.
If you believe in me, Senator...
I do.
Then, by thunder, I'll give them the best fight that's in me. I want to see you win, Senator, because I like what you stand for. Besides that, I've had a $50 bet on you ever since you announced for re-election.
Roosevelt was re-elected to the New York State Senate, and thus began one of the firmest friendships in modern politics. On March 1, 1913, Roosevelt was in Washington for the inauguration of Woodrow Wilson. He was offered the job of collector of the Port of New York. He refused it. He was offered the job of Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. He refused that. Later that same day, he ran into Josephus Daniels, who offered him the one job in the government he wanted. He took it like a shot. At 31, he became Assistant Secretary of the Navy. The next year, the World War. Franklin Roosevelt worked night and day that the United States Navy might be ready. In fact, he worked almost too well, for in 1917, about 10 days after the United States entered the war, he got a hurry call from the White House. Usher Ike Hoover took him straight to President Wilson's office.
Yes, Mr. President, you sent for me?
Yes, Mr. Roosevelt. This is General Hugh Scott, Chief of Staff of the Army. General, Mr. Roosevelt.
Yes, I've met
Roosevelt.
The General.
Now, Mr. Roosevelt, there's something I want to talk about.
Yes, Mr. President?
About the way you've been buying supplies for the Navy.
I admit I've cut the red tape in a few cases, but
That's not the point. It's not how you've been getting supplies, it's the amount.
Mr. President, I want the Navy to have everything it needs to do its job.
I know. You've done a wonderful job. However, we've also got our Army in this country. That's what General Scott is here to see me about. You've been buying up supplies so fast, in a great many cases, you've bought up all there are. I'm sorry, Mr. Roosevelt, but the Navy will have to give up some of its supplies to the Army.
One of the greatest problems of the World War was how to stop the ravages of U-boats. Franklin Roosevelt had a plan which many thought wild, but which some believed might work. He sent for Commander S.P. Fullenweider, an expert on mines.
That's my plan, Commander. We bottle up the northern exit to the North Sea so the U-boats can't get in or out.
Well, that's a long, long stretch of water, Mr. Roosevelt.
I know. Nearly 250 miles of it, and the tides are swift.
Oh, tell me, how about the British? Have they tried it?
The Admiralty won't hear of it. They say it's fantastic.
And how about our own Admiral Sims? He's over there.
He doesn't think it's feasible. In fact, there aren't many people who do think it will work. Admiral Harris is one exception, and...
And I'm another.
Good, good.
However, there is one drawback.
Yes?
With our present contact mine, we'd have to sew them 10 feet apart at 3 depths. Why, there aren't that many mines in the world.
Then we'll have to get a better mine.
The answer was found. The North Sea mine barrage became one of the wonders of the World War and helped the destruction of morale, which caused the mutiny in the German fleet. In June of 1918, Roosevelt was offered the Democratic nomination for the governorship of New York. He refused, suggesting another candidate, Alfred E. Smith. In July, he went abroad to inspect the battle zones. There, he met the leaders of the day and toured the actual fighting areas at Belleau Wood and at Chateau Thierry. When he boarded the Leviathan, he had decided to come home, resign, and don the uniform of a fighting officer in the United States Navy. This was not to be.
How are you feeling this morning, Mr. Roosevelt?
Very well. Fine, Doctor. How many days out are we?
Only two. You've been, well, asleep most of the time.
There was a lot of flu in Brest, I remember. Must have picked up a touch of it.
It's better you picked up flu in Brest than what they're having in New York now. In New York, there's an epidemic of infantile paralysis.
Well, thank heavens I'm too old for that. When I said goodbye at the dock, I remember telling them I'd be back on the next boat.
I'm afraid you won't be.
But I've got to. I'm resigning as assistant secretary and getting into the Navy. I'm going to ask them to assign me to one of the naval railway guns in France.
I may as well tell you, Mr. Roosevelt, when you leave the Leviathan in New York, you'll go on a stretcher.
But this flu, doctor, I'll shake it off.
You had flu. Now it's double pneumonia.
By the time he had sufficiently recovered, the war was ending. He did not become an officer in the Navy. In the White House, Woodrow Wilson was making plans for his League of Nations, an ideal for which he fought up to the point where he could fight no more. But when the Democratic Convention of 1920 nominated James M. Cox for president and Franklin D. Roosevelt for vice president, the fading Woodrow Wilson begged them to carry on the fight for the League. They knew it might mean the end of their chances, but they could not refuse. In the election that followed, they were defeated. In mid-August 1921, on a brief trip to his summer home at Campobello Island, Roosevelt felt slightly chilled. With his children, he went for a two-mile run. Feeling better, he went for a swim in the icy open water of Fundy Bay. Back at the house, the mail was waiting. He sat in his wet bathing suit, reading it until he felt chilled again. The next morning, he had symptoms of a cold, peculiar feelings in his legs. The second morning...
I can't move my legs. Why, I can't move them. Something's wrong. Anna, James, say, doesn't anybody ever get up in this house?
It's Louis Howe, Franklin.
Yes, I knew it was Louis. I didn't even have to turn over and look.
You're feeling better, I can tell that already.
Before we talk about me, Louis, we've got to talk about you. I've heard about the wonderful job you've been offered. More money than I'll ever be able to pay you. Take it, Louis, and owe it to your family.
When I first came to you, you told me it was my decision. It's my decision now. I'll stay.
But, Louis, you...
I'll stay. Now, how are you feeling?
Fine, fine. We sent for specialists. I've had a pretty cool career for any man, Louis. Thank God it got me instead of the children. Mother wants me to come to Hyde Park and stay there until, well, the rest of my day.
And what have you decided?
I've decided to live the rest of my life as if this illness had never happened.
Good, good. I can help you do it.
We can help him do it, Louis.
I can look after business matters for you, see people that you wouldn't be able to see.
I can attend political meetings for you, keep you posted on what's going on.
But, Eleanor, you don't know anything about politics.
Well, perhaps I don't know much now, but I will. I'll learn.
Then that's settled.
It's settled, Franklin. The three of us will work together.
For three tedious years, there was no improvement. Yet Franklin Roosevelt carried on his normal life, never once admitting that he could not walk. There had been a very slight improvement by 1924, when he managed Al Smith's campaign for the presidential nomination. On crutches, he placed Smith in nomination from the floor of Madison Square Garden. During the campaign, he worked 14 and 16 hours a day. Then he learned about Warm Springs, Georgia. The warm waters of the springs helped him, and he wanted to share its benefits with others less fortunate. Unknown even to some members of his family, he risked his private fortune in its development. Today, he considers it a major portion of his life's work. Then, on a night early in October 1928, the Democratic State Convention at Rochester had reached a stalemate. There was but one man strong enough to carry the state as candidate for governor and at the same time help Alfred E. Smith in his fight for the presidency. That man was speaking in a little Georgia town near Warm Springs. For 24 hours, he had refused to accept long-distance telephone calls. But as he was going out of the hall, he was hailed by a Georgia townsman.
Mr. Roosevelt. Mr. Roosevelt, sir.
Yes?
Great day in the morning, Mr. Roosevelt. I thought the speaking would never end. There you were, three flights up in the town hall, and here I've been holding on to the telephone waiting till you...
Oh, the telephone. I'm not accepting any calls.
You ain't what? Why, breathe fire and save matches, Mr. Roosevelt. Those friends of yours up in New York have spent a frying-sized fortune holding that long-distance wire open.
I'm sorry, but I...
I'm sorry, too, Mr. Roosevelt. I've been holding this wire open for 2 hours while you've been up there speaking.
Oh, well, I suppose I may as well get it over with. Hello, this is Roosevelt. Yes? Yes, but I explained all that in my telegram to Governor Smith. I told him I didn't want to enter public life until I completely regained my health. Yes. Yes, no. Of course, I hate to see the Democrats lose New York State. But I've said so many times that I don't want to run for... What's that? What's that? Well, I don't know. No, I'd rather not answer that. I'll wait till it happens. If it does, well, we'll see.
You gonna run? Let them run you for governor, Mr. Roosevelt? You gonna run?
I don't know. They say the convention is going to draft me. I hope not. If they do, well, we'll see.
Just 2 days before that telephone call, and unknown to anybody, he had taken his first steps without aid of any kind. He carried the state, though Smith lost it in the nominal election. Franklin Roosevelt re-entered public life as governor of New York. When he was nominated at Chicago in 1932, Roosevelt made a dramatic flight from New York to make his acceptance speech in person while the convention was still in session.
On the farms, in the large metropolitan areas, in the smaller cities and in the villages, millions of our citizens cherish the hope that their old standards of living and of thought have not gone forever. Those millions cannot and shall not hope in vain. I pledge you, I pledge myself to a new deal for the American people.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt has said,
"This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper." So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And Franklin Delano Roosevelt has said,
"There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny."
The WILL Playhouse, through the courtesy of the National Broadcasting Company, has been privileged to present the story of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The script was written by Welburn Kelly on material furnished by Ernest K. Lindley, noted biographer of the president.
For the